Thank you, everyone. You may be seated if you're standing. And good morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is State versus Thomas, and we're going to start by making sure that everybody is here and introducing ourselves because we are WebEx. So I'm Mike Havikin, I'm the Chief Justice, and by seniority, as to number of years on the court will introduce themselves, and that means Justice Miller-Lerman?
Yep, Justice Miller-Lerman here participating by WebEx. Good morning.
William Castle by WebEx. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Jeff Funk. Good morning.
Jonathan Papik.
And John Frydenberg.
Very good. Thank you very much. And counsel, Mr. Wampler, are you here this morning?
Yes, Your Honor. Travis Wampler for appellant.
Good morning to you. And Ms. Osborne, are you here this morning?
Yes, Your Honor. Jordan Osborne for the appellee, State of Nebraska.
And good morning to you. Does anyone have any questions before we begin on State versus Thomas?
No, Your Honor.
No questions. Then we shall begin. Mr. Wampler, good morning to you. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Travis Wampler. I'm an assistant public defender in Douglas County, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Arias Thomas. Essentially, my view of what the state is asking the court to do here is to extend a ruling from the U.S. Circuit Court for the Sixth Circuit, that case being U.S. versus Markson, to apply to a case here where the reasonable suspicion to initiate a traffic stop was based on a vehicle description alone, without any description of the driver of the vehicle, either at the time of the alleged incident or at the time of the stop. I think the preliminary and dispositive question here is whether or not independent reasonable suspicion existed to pull over the vehicle Mr. Thomas was driving due to whether or not a traffic infraction occurred. I think we're all agreed that the law is settled that a traffic infraction, no matter how minor, is reasonable suspicion to initiate a traffic stop. And the district court in this case, I don't think made a clear ruling on whether or not, in its opinion, a traffic infraction occurred. And I think that depends on a finding of fact that should have been made by the district court. And from the record before the court here today, that finding of fact was never made. There was a motion to suppress held prior to the trial in this case. The motion to suppress was denied at that time. And Judge Coffey's ruling on the record was that any issues of the officer's credibility could be reserved for trial, which appears to be reserving the issue for trial after the court had heard the trial testimony of Officer Fadima of the Omaha Police Department.
Mr. Wampler?
Yes.
Is it fair to say from reading the arguments in the appellant's brief that the only issue before us is challenging the stop in this situation, in this appeal?
No. The issues would be whether or not a traffic infraction occurred and whether the record is clear regarding that finding.
So I'm sorry, the basis of the stop.
The basis of the stop, yes.
Okay.
A traffic infraction occurred, and then the secondary issue would be if a traffic infraction did not occur, if the record is clear that there was no traffic infraction, whether or not there was reasonable suspicion to initiate a traffic stop based on a description of the vehicle alone, based on an Omaha Police Department bulletin. I think the court can avoid addressing the second question on whether or not reasonable suspicion exists from a vehicle description alone, if the preliminary issue of whether or not a traffic infraction occurred is addressed first.
Wouldn't either basis under the state's argument be sufficient to justify the stop?
It would. But the reason I think the court should rely on the first question is there's no need to extend the interpretation of the Fourth Amendment in the state of Nebraska, at least, in order to address the issue of reasonable suspicion based on a vehicle description alone. If that issue can be resolved by a settled issue of law, that being a traffic infraction being sufficient to initiate the traffic stop.
Well, let's for the sake of argument, let's say this court agrees with you regarding the traffic infraction. So let's move to the second basis that the state is arguing is sufficient, the police bulletin. Why would the information in the police bulletin not be sufficient to provide a justification for the stop?
Well, I think if the court analyzes the facts of this case under the facts of U.S. versus Marks, and I have to concede that they're very similar. The stop there being based on a vehicle description alone, the description of the perpetrators not matching the actual driver of the vehicle at the time of the stop. I don't think there is a good reason to extend that ruling to make that law in the state of Nebraska. In my research, the only case that I was able to find, and that's after the state brought it to my attention in their brief, was U.S. versus Markson. And my further research of that case only indicates three published opinions where outside the Sixth Circuit, that is, three published opinions outside of the Sixth Circuit, where the rationale of that case, well, actually the citation of that case is mentioned at all. There's a case that came out of New York City regarding a stop of a person on a subway platform that used the analysis in Markson regarding the passage of time between the alleged offense and the arrest. But due to it being the stop of a person, obviously it had nothing to do with a vehicle description. And then there was a case from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania where Markson is mentioned in a footnote, but is not part of the actual ruling. And then also a Supreme Court decision in the state of Florida, Tucker versus state of Florida, that addressed the issue again regarding staleness, regarding the passage of time, but not
why,
the issue.
Why should we not follow Markson?
Well, in 15 years since the case was decided, no other circuit has decided that it would be a good idea to adopt that reasoning. I think there's
some. Has it come up in other circuits?
Well, my research was not exhaustive enough to examine every factual scenario to determine whether or not this particular set of facts has arisen. But I think that the focus that the Sixth Circuit puts on the vehicle rather than the person is bad for policy reasons. Obviously, we're not here to re-argue a Sixth Circuit case, but the court's ruling in Markson, the judge that issued the opinion, that would be Judge Reeves, a district court judge who wrote the opinion for the Sixth Circuit in that case. His reasoning was that Terry allows the stop of a vehicle, which isn't quite true, since Terry allows the stop of a vehicle driven by a person. The reason that a traffic stop creates reasonable suspicion to initiate a traffic stop is that vehicle is driven by a person who has presumably committed a traffic infraction. And when that vehicle is stopped, the person driving the vehicle is cited for that traffic infraction.
Is there, I beg your pardon, is there a remedy that you would seek with respect to bulletins? And that is, if a bulletin just identifies a vehicle, you don't think it's enough. But if it's a bulletin that indicates a vehicle and a little bit of information about a person, would that be sufficient?
Well, I think it depends on the short answer would be yes. I think it depends on the amount of information regarding the person. But the case, can everyone still hear me? I lost video.
We can hear you.
The Supreme Court case on which Markson relied, which is U.S. v. Hensley, a U.S. Supreme Court case, focused on the person regarding a police bulletin with a description of a person. And that extended reasonable suspicion for the arrest to extend after the crime was completed, but it was still a bulletin regarding a person.
Mr. Wampler, to what significance does the vehicle damage have in our analysis?
Well, I think that it would provide additional description of the vehicle that would be analogous to the partial plate description given in Markson. But in Markson, the police officers followed the car for, I think it was 11 days. And even though the driver of the vehicle did not fit the description of a suspect, law enforcement still observed the same person operating that vehicle for 11 days, indicating that this person had a connection to the vehicle. In this case, there was absolutely no description or observation of the person driving the vehicle.
Yes, isn't there a connection to the vehicle if the person is driving it? He's in it.
Well, yes, there is at that particular time and place. The distinction I make with Markson is this person obviously has a substantial connection to this vehicle since they've driven it on 11 consecutive days of observation. The fact that this person is driving this vehicle, that is an unseen person, creates control at the time of the stop, but doesn't create any sort of connection between the vehicle on the date of the incident 3 days prior.
In this case, there was surveillance also, was there not? This was there not was, instantaneous stop of a car.
There was surveillance for a few hours on the day of the stop, but from the record, there was no observation of the driver whatsoever. The officer saw someone get into the car, but did not get a good enough view to compare it to a photo of the owner, and there was no description of any suspects.
Counsel, so, would the if the stop had occurred on the day of the shooting, would that change your position? Is it the 3 days have any impact on your argument?
Well, I think it does, because if the stop was made shortly after the shots fired incident was reported, I think there would be reasonable suspicion to believe the person driving at that time would have some sort of connection to the alleged shooting incident. I think even several hours, let alone 3 days, without a description of the driver in any way would be enough to get rid of reasonable suspicion regarding stopping the vehicle based on description alone.
Prior to the stop, were the authorities aware that this vehicle was owned by Mr. Thomas?
From my review of the record, it appears officers did not try to find the owner information until they were doing the observation on the day of the stop. If there was investigation into who the owner was prior to that, it's not indicated in the record.
Your time is up, Mr. Wampler. Appreciate very much your answering questions beyond your time. That takes us then to Ms. Osborne. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Following a jury trial, appellant was found guilty of possession of a firearm by a felon, possession of alprazolam, and possession of marijuana. The only issue on appeal is whether the district court erred in overruling appellant's motion to suppress. Appellant argues law enforcement lacked reasonable suspicion or probable cause to conduct the stop of his vehicle. The state disagrees. The investigatory stop of appellant's vehicle was lawful because police had reasonable suspicion to believe the vehicle was involved in a shots fired incident that occurred 3 days earlier and one block from where the vehicle was located. The Fourth Amendment permits an investigative stop of a vehicle if officers have a reasonable suspicion the vehicle or its occupants are involved in criminal activity. And that comes from the Eighth Circuit, cited in multiple opinions. In such a case, officers may briefly stop an individual and make reasonable inquiries aimed at confirming or dispelling the suspicion. Appellant concedes in the brief that reasonable suspicion may be based on a vehicle description alone. However, he argues there's no authority to support an investigatory stop based on vehicle description alone when the reported incident occurred 3 days earlier.
With regard to the investigatory stop, here the officers approached the vehicle with weapons drawn. Was the force used by the officers here so excessive to move this from a tier two stop to a tier three arrest?
No, Your Honor. And that's addressed extensively in the brief. The Terry stop did not amount to an arrest of Thomas. The nature of the felony stop did not exceed the bounds of an investigatory stop because the actions of the police during the stop are reasonably necessary to protect their personal safety and maintain the status quo during the stop. When officers are presented with serious danger in the course of carrying out an investigative detention, they may brandish weapons or even constrain the suspect with handcuffs in order to control the scene and protect their safety. Again, that's cited multiple times in multiple opinions by the Eighth Circuit. In determining whether an video on everybody went out, but in determining whether an officer's actions met the Fourth Amendment standard of reasonableness, the issue is whether the officer has an objectively reasonable concern for officer safety or suspicion of danger. So in this particular case, there was a drive-by shooting where 15 rounds were discharged from a vehicle. The police bulletin warned officers to use caution as the gun used in the shooting had not been recovered. And due to appellant's vehicle's suspected involvement in a recent shooting and the fact that the firearm used had not been recovered, the officers had reason to believe the driver of the vehicle could be armed or there could be weapons inside the vehicle. This created an objectively reasonable concern for officer safety or suspicion of danger that permitted the officers to conduct a felony stop whereby they exited their vehicles with weapons drawn. They issued verbal commands for Thomas to exit the vehicle with his hands visible. A similar stop was actually conducted in the Markson case where the officers displayed weapons. They removed Markson from his vehicle and they placed him in handcuffs. And in that case, the Sixth Circuit concluded that such measures did not convert the Terry stop into an arrest. And then during the actual stop in this case, Thomas escalated the situation when he refused to comply with the repeated instructions to exit the vehicle. That required the officers to physically remove him from the vehicle. Thomas continued to resist those efforts, and he twice reached down towards a seat, which was an indication he may be reaching for a weapon. So his conduct posed a serious threat to the officer's safety and resulted then in the need to deploy a taser in order to remove him from the vehicle, and he was placed in handcuffs for officer safety. Those actions were reasonable under the circumstances and did not convert the investigative stop to an arrest. So all we're talking about here is reasonable suspicion. We're not talking about probable cause.
Ms. Osborne, what role does the vehicle damage in the description play? And let me extend that question a little bit by asking, is the state suggesting that in the absence of such vehicle damage, that reasonable suspicion would have existed with respect to every 2010 Mazda 3 that's dark gray in color?
Your Honor, I think distinctive damage to this vehicle is extremely important in this case. It's a very important factor. The Sixth Circuit has issued a more recent case sort of following up on United States versus Markson, which is United States versus Jackson. It's not cited in the state's brief, but it's 700 Federal Appendix 411. It's from 2017. And in that case, the Sixth Circuit stated, as particularity of the description increases, the effects of delay decrease. So the more descriptive of the vehicle that exists, for example, in Markson, there's a license plate or a partial plate that's provided in addition to the make, model, and color of the vehicle. Here, we have distinctive, unique damage to the vehicle that's not just reported by a witness. It's actually included in surveillance video of the shooting. And so there's a still photo of the actual vehicle involved in the shooting that's included in that police bulletin.
Just how distinctive is the damage?
The damage is a distinctive not only location, but also a shape in the area of the driver's side rear quarter panel. And then there's also rust markings running along the bottom of the driver's side of the vehicle. Those can be observed in the exhibits provided during the suppression hearing and during the trial. There's an exhibit of the police bulletin that includes the actual photo, a still shot of the surveillance video of the vehicle involved in the shooting. Then there's also photographs of the vehicle after the traffic stop was conducted. And you can see that the damage to the driver's side of the vehicle matches the police bulletin. So in this particular case...
May I just interrupt for a moment then, focusing on the damage, right? The bulletin details the damage to the vehicle in question. Is that correct?
The bulletin includes a photograph, a still photograph of the vehicle that was taken from the surveillance video of the drive-by shooting. So there's actually not only a description of the make, model, and color of the vehicle, there's an actual photo of the vehicle that law enforcement is searching for. So in this particular case, that distinctive damage is very relevant to the facts. If you were to have a situation, say, for example, the description is a white sedan, that is such a general description that could match hundreds or thousands of cars even just that general area of Omaha. Here you have a much more specific description and an actual photograph of the vehicle that includes that unique and distinctive damage.
I beg your pardon. This may be distinguished from, say, an event. This is a shots fired event that triggers this, but a hit and run where there's damage to the vehicle. That would be more less tenuous, right? You have a hit and run, and in the course of that event, a car was damaged. That would be a tighter connection factually.
I don't know that it would. I mean, you have distinctive damage either way. So I don't know that it would matter in a significant way. In the Jackson case, there was a vehicle that was parked outside of a duplex that was burglarized during the night. And that vehicle was observed by a neighbor. It had never been observed in the neighborhood before. And that vehicle happened to have no front bumper. That's distinctive damage. And in that case, actually, the vehicle didn't really have a specific connection to the crime committed. The police did not know for sure if that vehicle was connected to the burglary at the duplex or not. But because of its geographic and time location being parked outside of the building, they believe that it was possibly connected to the crime. And again, then you have the distinctive damage on the vehicle, which was the basis for the stop there. So in this particular case, the vehicle that was stopped here, Thomas's vehicle, there was reasonable suspicion based upon all of the information known, and Nebraska has adopted the imputed or collective knowledge doctrine, which would apply in this case. Unless there are further questions,
Ms. Osborne, what is the status of the traffic stop in this case?
Your Honor, I believe that this court can resolve the entire case without getting into whether there was a traffic stop or whether the district court made proper factual or legal findings in its written order. The reasonable suspicion is sufficient for the stop, regardless of whether there was a traffic stop or a traffic violation or not.
Thank you.
Unless there are any further questions, I'd ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Wampler, thank you. Ms. Osborne, thank you very much. And we will proceed now to the next case of the day, but we have a little break before we do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We'll see you.
Thank you.